You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
Tonight's gonna be a good night. Tonight's gonna be a good guy. Hell, did you ever get an earworm? You know, like a catchy piece of music that just loops again and again in your brain, like one little refrain of maddeningly irritating music that you can't stop, I guess, singing to yourself, even when you really want to? That's a dumb question, I guess. Like, everybody gets earworms, I assume. I never really thought about this, though. Do some people get more earworms than other people? Do some people get earworms more easily, more often than everybody else? Imagine if that was you. Like, what if every time you heard a song, it crawled into your brain and put itself on infinite loop? Imagine if you had to consciously avoid hearing music because you know this will happen. You'll have no control over it. The earworm will slither in, push your other thoughts away, and just repeat over and over. I mean, what I'm describing, that would be like being allergic to music. And that would be awful. I mean, first of all, you'd miss out on music. But it would be a lot worse than that, you know. If you were allergic to music, you would have to stay away from shopping malls and stores, from elevators, from cabs and Ubers. It would be hard to hold down a job. For God's sakes, it would be hard to set foot out of your door. It would be very, very bad to be allergic to music, if that were a real thing. Which, it turns out, it is. And frankly, it sounds like a living hell. In a moment, journalist Avis Favreau is going to introduce you to a woman who has this terrible affliction. And she's going to tell you the story of what she did about it. Wait for it.
Today's episode contains talk about suicidal ideation. If you or someone you know is thinking about suicide, please call or text 988. Support is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And please take care as you listen to this story.
I don't know them, and I think they're from Moscow.
Yes. Most
probably.
This is moving day for Anya.
So I'm in the middle of my move to Ottawa. My fiance found a job there and he's liking it so far.
There are bags of papers all over the floor. Her father, Dmitry, who's helping her, reaches down and picks one up. And inside are Anya's notes from when she was 9 years old and the family lived in Russia. The handwriting looks a lot like that of an adult, even though she was just a child.
Yeah, no, in Russia, everyone learns to write in cursive at a really early age. And so when I first got here and all the kids were sort of like holding the pencil like this and printing those like block letters, like, what is going on?
It is hard to imagine that this happy, hopeful young woman you're hearing was once on death's door. She was suicidal, fearful, with a problem that frankly stumped most of her doctors. 7 years ago, Anya was not only incapacitated, she was hospitalized with something that gives most of us pleasure, music. But she could not stop hearing endless music blasting inside of her head. She had no idea why, no idea what was wrong with her, and no one did. It almost pushed her over the edge. Because of the stigma around mental illness, we agreed to protect Anya's privacy, so we're not using her full name. But I can tell you, she's a woman in her late 20s with shoulder-length brown hair, hazel eyes, and a warm, engaging smile and a big heart because she wants to help others. I'm going to say again, I can't thank you enough for doing this. Let me start off by asking you why you could keep this private, but you decided to say yes to doing an interview. Why?
Well, I know for a fact there are a lot of people out there struggling and perhaps not even sure where to begin, but also encourage them not to give up. Yeah, never to give up.
Anya's life was full of promise when she came to Canada as a child. But by the time she was in her late teens, this straight-A student who can speak six languages began to feel trapped.
Like the prison metaphor is very real. Like it feels like you've been taken hostage by your brain and you're stuck with it. You're in a mental prison. So there's quite literally no escape.
And that mental prison that she's talking about is actually something many of us have experienced here and there in our lives. We call them earworms. 98% of us have them. It comes from the German word Ohrwurm, which means musical itch. We get them, but they don't last for long. But in Anya's case, they actually became the bars to her jail cell.
Just imagine that you turn the volume of that internal, radio way up and that it's very persistent and it won't go away.
You hated music then for a while.
Oh, I did, yeah, very much.
You hated it. You heard it all the time. It never stopped.
It drove me crazy, like even just going into a Shoppers, like I became aware that we actually have music in many places we go that I'd never been aware before, but sometimes I would go into Shoppers and just leave, and I was like, and especially around like Christmas, which I think even people who do not have this problem complain that the Christmas songs everywhere just get like insufferable, but yeah, for me it was even more so.
What most of us find annoying actually drove Anya to the brink of insanity. And knowing six different languages meant six times more chances for these earworms.
Some of it was in Russian, some in English, some in like other languages I know, even in Yiddish.
She was desperate for relief, and Anya actually tried to drown out the earworms by using music without lyrics.
So sometimes I would put on classical music. Like I would have some kind of background instrumental music on all the time as I was eating, as I was going to sleep, as I was just trying to drown out the internal radio that was blasting in my head.
It didn't work. And it got so bad that even an image was enough to trigger the earworms.
So I would maybe, you know, see a picture of the Eiffel Tower and then get like Edith Piaf, like just kind of blasting. No, rien de rien. Like it wouldn't go away. So it was, there's this super hyperactive, like, musical sort of inner Google that was just completely gone off the rails.
Minutes, hours, days.
Constantly at like two full years of my life.
With music in your head.
With music in my head 24/7.
How did you manage to get through each day?
It was a complete nightmare. I did develop, you know, severe concurrent depression just from the hopelessness of it. And I did become quite suicidal. So I had a lot of suicidal thoughts. And
so your parents must have been terrified.
It was horrifying. Yeah. Like at some point they realized that they were no longer able to leave me alone, like at all, that someone had to be there like 24/7.
Anya had no idea that those earworms were actually a sign of something that was more insidious and much more difficult to stop. Long before the earworms, there were other hints that something was wrong. September 2012. We're at the University of Toronto. In a crowded library among all the first-year students who are huddled over their laptops is 17-year-old Anya, and she is filled with anxiety. Her brain is telling her, though, that she's going to be okay if she opens her computer a certain way.
When I would sit down to work at my laptop or even like unlock my phone, like I would try to do that when the time was, let's say, 12:10 or 12:15, 12:20, so some kind of multiple of five and not the like minutes in between.
Then when she's heading home, after a long day at school, Anya notices something else. Her brain tells her that if she walks a certain way on the street, she'll be calm.
If I was walking outside and walking down a street and then the traffic light like lit up green, then I would feel kind of compelled to cross to that, follow the traffic light, cross to the other side of the street, keep walking along like on the other side of the street. So I would go and like zigzags.
I think we all have quirks.
Mm-hmm.
We all have quirks. I can't
go.
I have to go down the stairs clockwise from
right.
upstairs. I don't mm-hmm. know why. I can't explain it. It's odd.
It just feels right.
But it just
yeah.
feels better.
Better.
Yeah, it feels yeah. like, yes. So I just accept that with that. I'm sure
yes.
a lot of people have
yeah.
that.
Yeah, to a certain extent, we all do. I think it felt harmless at the time. It felt like a game. It felt, I guess, good in a weird way that I felt like I was following some sort of, like when you play a game, you have to follow the rules of a game, right?
These are odd rules and mind games, but Anya continued to follow them and never told her family, her friends, and never said anything when she met a guy she was studying with in Europe that summer.
So I was studying abroad in Berlin, taking a class through U of T, and I met a guy from Barcelona, and then it was a very kind of young adult, novel-worthy situation.
Novel-worthy.
Yeah.
Okay. You were swept off your feet.
Yes, I was really swept off my feet, and I was very happy, like I was in love, like things were good.
But Anya's happiness didn't last. She and her boyfriend broke up. So what happened? The stress of that moment.
The stress of that moment triggered like a tidal wave.
Describe that when you say tidal wave.
Yeah. So basically I had like a mental health breakdown.
And that mental collapse wasn't just caused by heartache. It was also her no longer able to cope with those head games.
And then all of a sudden, I had this new level of insight that I didn't have before. And I thought, you know what, like all those messed up like behaviors, I have to end that too. Like that's not okay. And I just stopped kind of cold turkey, which was probably a terrible idea. Your brain just kind of goes haywire. So that's what happened to me, I think, at the time, is that I abruptly stopped engaging in all of those behaviors. And that's where it really went on the offensive.
Anya's brain hit back hard. Within weeks, her brain was filled with very negative thoughts that she would never amount to anything. And then she stopped sleeping, and then the earworms began. She hardly left her parents' home and barely went to school. Her parents were worried sick about their daughter's safety, so they took her to emergency, not once, not twice, three times, desperate for someone to tell them what was wrong with their daughter. In the end, she was admitted to the psychiatric ward in a downtown Toronto hospital. When they got you into the hospital and a doctor uncovered the OCD, the obsessive compulsive disorder, as a diagnosis, what did you think?
I think I felt guilty that part of me had probably known all along, because, you know, if I had been honest with myself and, like, determined to find out what it was that was wrong with me, like, probably I could have figured it out.
Obsessive compulsive disorder causes people to have obsessions about horrible things they think might happen, and that triggers anxiety. When they try to relieve those bad feelings, they use rituals or compulsions. The most common symptom that most of us know about is when people wash their hands repeatedly to try to get rid of germs. Treatment for OCD can be tricky. Some people improve with anti-anxiety medications or antipsychotics. There's also cognitive behavior therapy, or CBT, to retrain the brain to stop the games. But for Anya, tragically, none of those two first-line treatments worked, not a one. And so in 2017, a suicidal Anya was admitted to Canada's only inpatient program for OCD.
Everybody who comes to our program in Ontario has treatment-resistant illness, typically quite severe.
That is psychiatrist Peggy Richter. She's the head of the Thompson Center for Anxiety at Toronto's Sunnybrook Health Sciences. It's tucked away in a corner of this Midtown City Hospital. And from the outside, it looks like a resort with Muskoka chairs and a cottage-like vibe. But Dr. Richter's program is intense. It starts with 8 weeks of therapy to try to stop those obsessions and the rituals that patients use to manage all of this anxiety.
So in OCD, we do a lot of focusing on the behavioral side, meaning we want to challenge the OCD-related behaviors or the compulsions with what we call ritual prevention. So people are going to be facing their triggers or their fears and learning to do it without doing the rituals.
And this program has a very long waiting list. Why? Because it's already filled to capacity with people struggling with chronic and treatment-resistant OCD. People who are trying to claw their way out of their own mental prisons, just like the one that Anya found herself in. Anya's kryptonite was music that caused the earworms. Meet one of Dr. Richter's other patients, Leah. She is terrified of the number 6.
Leah, what are we going to be working on today? What's the goal of this exposure?
Make me feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
What you're about to hear is a therapist who's going to expose Leah to the very thing she's frightened of. 6.
So just to review, your OCD is aimed at protecting yourself and your loved ones from harm, which what we would call hyper-responsibility.
And so this therapist is going to trigger Leah's OCD by making her say 6 words, that's her danger number, to train her over time not to be afraid of the number 6 and what she thinks might happen.
Do you want me to say it with you?
Yes.
Okay, 3, 2, 1. Maybe my mom will crash today.
Good job.
That's a horrible feeling.
How strong are the urges to undo? 10 out of 10 now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you're doing great.
But the motivation is still 10 out of 10.
Good.
Too, so that's That's what's helping me.
You're a rock star. Give me a high five. Give me six high fives.
With all of the laughing, it might sound like Leah isn't struggling at all. But she quickly explains what's really going on.
And I'm laughing to stop myself from crying.
Okay.
Just to put that out there.
That's okay. Like, that, it can be a coping strategy.
It is.
I might say something like, what's the laughter about? You know, can we process this feeling? What, you know, what's really showing up for you here? And if you want to debrief that more after this, we can.
Okay.
Leah's been in the program for 3 weeks now, and she is slowly making progress. But when Anya was in this program, it was an epic fail for her. When she was exposed the exact same way to her fear of music and the earworms, she just couldn't take it.
They did actually try to like approach it in that way and try and like play, force me to like listen to music, but I don't believe it was a very good idea. Like, I completely lost it. I had like a big suicidal kind of phase, and I thought, okay, the medication's not helping, the therapy's not helping, so like that's it. Like, I have to throw in the towel. And in fact, like, it kind of put me at higher risk at the time.
Through a maze of hallways at Sunnybrook Hospital is the office of another doctor here, a neurosurgeon that Anya saw as her last hope. His name is Nir Lipsman.
Let's talk about Anya. Do you remember the first time you met her?
I do. She had what we call a pure O OCD, so obsession. Lots of obsessions related to musical obsessions. Not as many compulsions, but significant obsessions.
So what are the options for a patient like Anya who's failed to respond to medications and intensive therapy? Brain surgery. Its history goes back to the late 1800s when doctors thought they could fix psychiatric illnesses with lobotomies. That's literally going in to cut part of the brain. And the first lobotomy was done in Canada at Toronto General Hospital in 1941. But by today's standards, the procedure is pretty primitive and very dangerous. In the 1960s, doctors refined the approach for OCD using what's called a capsulotomy.
There we target a part of the brain known as the anterior limb of the internal capsule, also a kind of highway in the brain connecting key structures that we know are very important for decision making and fear and anxiety.
They surgically cut part of the brain linked to anxiety, breaking a connection. And once that little connection in the brain was cut, the patient's anxiety often lifted. But they had to open the skull to perform this brain surgery, and that had a host of risks, like strokes, like infections, personality changes, and in rare cases, these people with OCD died.
Because the tools we were using at the time were just much more crude, weren't nearly as precise as the tools that we have today. Imaging was in its infancy, if available at all.
But what about Anya with her almost deadly earworms? The solution that Dr. Lipsman proposed was here, in this bright room inside the hospital. In the middle of the room is a big white cylindrical machine that makes this strange pulsating noise. It almost sounds like it's breathing. Is an MRI. It literally swallows patients into this hole in the middle while doctors take pictures of the brain and in this case offer something called focused ultrasound. It's already used to treat conditions like Parkinson's and trembling hands. But in this case there's no drilling into the skull, no knife. It uses ultrasound waves to penetrate and kill the brain tissue.
And 1,000 ultrasound waves are directed through the skull onto a discrete point, treating OCD.
The first one for OCD was done here in 2018.
What does it do for you personally?
I mean, from a purely nuts and bolts surgical perspective, it's very cool what we're doing. It really never gets old to access the brain in real time through the skull with sound waves. You know, the same waves that you're hearing me talk right now, you can direct 1,000 of those through the brain to generate a lesion. So that's pretty cool to do that on a regular basis.
And so on January 28th, 2019, the then 24-year-old Anya became one of the first people in Canada to have focused ultrasound to treat her OCD. Step one, measure the thickness of her skull. Interestingly, Dr. Lipsman has found that the ultrasound therapy only really works on people with strong, thick skulls.
And if you have an unfavorable skull, does that disqualify you?
So far in the field, there are only very few patients who are totally disqualified.
Anya's skull was deemed appropriate. Step two. Shave off all of her shoulder-length brown hair in order to secure a special helmet on her head. You lost all your hair.
I did, yeah. And interestingly, like it is a big deal, and especially like for a young woman, it's pretty radical having your head completely shaved. But funnily enough, I looked at myself in the mirror and I got this very positive feeling. I was like, okay, it's actually a good thing because all of that hair that I had grown, like while being completely miserable and suffering and just having those horrible couple years, was like gone. And somehow it kind of symbolized a fresh start, I guess.
Minutes before going inside the MRI, Dr. Lipsman gave Anya a small ball to squeeze with her hands in case the procedure became painful at all. The ball would trigger an alarm to stop the machines.
And I just remember thinking, like, no matter what happens, I'm not squeezing that thing. Because I was so adamant, I was just so determined to, like, go through it and have them do it that I didn't want to, like, jeopardize the outcome. So I was like, okay, you're not squeezing that thing. Like, I don't care what happens, but we're just going to go through this.
All of that focused ultrasound generates heat to kill that tiny part of Anya's brain. When they actually burn, it's hot enough to boil an egg.
Not quite. So our body temperature is about 37 degrees. And a permanent lesion is only achieved when you get above 52 or 53 degrees. And for OCD, for all of these indications, we target about 56, 57 degrees.
For how long?
For a good 10 seconds.
We're going to do the first sonication now, okay?
At one point, I did feel a pretty sharp pain, and like I remember screaming out, like inside the machine. But I didn't like squeeze that emergency brake thingy. Yeah. But then once I was out, after the procedure was done, they put me in a wheelchair. Like, and I said, okay, I'm never doing this again.
Anya never had to do another treatment. It was one and done. In fact, in the months that followed, Anya's transformation was slow, but nothing short of remarkable. Once on the verge of ending her life, her biggest concern now is whether her plants are going to survive the move to Ottawa.
Yeah, we're very proud for having kept them alive so far.
And remember those torturous earworms?
Caught in a moment, trapped in a lifetime.
The songs slowly faded away. Her hair grew back, and Anya's confidence flourished. Now she can open her computer at leisure, she can walk on any side of the street, and next week she even starts a new job teaching French at a private school in Ottawa. Are you cured?
I wish I could say that. I wouldn't go as far as to say that I'm cured. I think my OCD is still around, but I think what the surgery did is it gave me power back to be able to address it. You know, therapy, and I'm still taking some medication, and we're gradually reducing it and trying to figure out what my sort of new baseline, to what extent I'm going to need medication.
How about the word remission?
Yes, I would say it's in remission. I'd say I have a happy, full life, which is miraculous.
And in the fall, Anya and her fiancé will be getting married. She's also finishing a master's degree, and she'll be turning 30. A new, busy life. But there is one thing she tells me she will never take for granted.
I'd forgotten what the sound of silence was like. I started to forget what it was like to have some mental clarity and just some peace and quiet. So yeah, that's very precious.
Five people have had focused ultrasound in Canada for their obsessive compulsive disorder. Sunnybrook has follow-up data on 17 of them. What's your sense of the success rate?
So about 50 to 60% at 1 year of patients who undergo the procedure, they see a significant reduction in the most commonly used measure of OCD. It means that their disease is no longer in the severe state.
Doctors filed a request with the Ontario government to get the procedure publicly funded so they could help more people like Anya. But an expert committee decided not yet because they felt there wasn't enough evidence. There is an appeal underway of that decision.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. Our website is canadaland.com. Today's episode was presented by Avis Favreau and reported by Avis Favreau and Kevin O'Keefe. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Max Collins is our production manager. Karen Puleze is our editor-in-chief. Our theme music is by So Cold. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Law professor and podcaster Michael Geist, hello.
Hello, Jesse.
Today on the show, Michael, Google is illegal. In the U.S., anyhow, their monopoly on search has been ruled illegal. What about here in Canada? No, here we just want Google to be nicer. Welcome to Shortcuts, Michael, where we talk about the news.
In a landmark ruling, a federal judge has found that tech giant Google broke antitrust laws.
Apple's lucrative relationship with Google could be at risk after a judge ruled that the search giant is operating an illegal monopoly.
Google currently controls roughly 90% of the world's internet searches.
It's not a crime to have the most popular product that everyone uses. However, the big deal here is that a judge is saying the way Google conducts its business is actually breaking the law because it is illegal to act in a way that harms competition.
Michael, they did it. They actually ruled that Google, they've built an illegal monopoly on search. We've been talking about this for years. And it finally happened. Is this as big a deal as it seemed to me?
It is a big deal. It's, I think, the first of a number of cases that involved not just Google, but a number of companies. But in Google's case, there are at least a couple of big antitrust cases. This was one about how it built its search dominance and the argument that it's essentially bought its way through large amounts of traffic that made it tough for anyone else to compete. There is, in some ways, especially from a media perspective, an even bigger case that's upcoming in the fall, and that involves its alleged dominance when it comes to the advertising market and the digital ad market. And that could have huge implications in terms of what ad markets look like if a similar finding is reached. This one here, though, on search, has echoes of what people have been saying for a long time and feels a bit like Back to the Future in terms of kind of Microsoft years ago.
Well, the lore is that because Microsoft was entangled back then, that's why they didn't acquire or otherwise kill Google. And that's what allowed Google to become Google. That was an example that's often cited of like, this is how why antitrust works. It allows competition to flourish. We wouldn't have a Google if they hadn't come down on Microsoft the way that they did.
There's no doubt, I think, that these kinds of cases have a chilling effect, let's say, on some of the acquisition plans of these big companies. And some would argue that the horse is already out of the barn, whether it's Meta having bought up companies like Instagram over the years or Google having bought up DoubleClick and a range of other mergers that took place over the years have created the dominance that we have right now and that it's a little late to put the toothpaste back in the tube. But what we're already seeing is that it's pretty tough for some of these big companies to move ahead with the kind of large acquisitions that they did a number of years ago. I mean, it's pretty clear that antitrust regulators, competition regulators in the United States and elsewhere are far more skeptical about these kinds of mergers than they were years ago.
It seems like such a big deal because, you know, in years of doing tech talk stuff, it was always, you know, in a perfect world, governments would get serious about breaking these companies up. And now it's happened. And my understanding of like the specifics of this one are that in 1 year alone, in 2022, Google paid Apple $20 billion so that they would be the default web browser that pops up when you open Apple's Safari web browser. And that is how they created an illegal monopoly on search. And they also did that with cell phone providers, that when you open up that browser and Google's just sitting there, it's not necessarily because Google's the best, it's because they're paying for it. And some of the funny stuff that came out in court where Apple was saying, well, that's not true. We like Google better. Yes, we take their money, but there's not enough money in the world for us to make it Bing. And I guess that argument didn't wash.
Given the past of Apple and Microsoft, that's perhaps a bit more credible argument than some of the other companies that might have alternatives. But you're right. The allegation here is that Google is big and by far the biggest, obviously, when it comes to search, not just because it's good. I mean, I think many people would say perfectly good search engine, but because it was able to leverage its size and leverage these deals to squeeze out other would-be competitors when it came to becoming the default search engine. And Google would say, listen, people use us because we're good. They can always switch if they want. But the devil is in the defaults, as they sometimes say. The judge, I think, acknowledged that, yeah, sure, Google may be perfectly good. Yes, there's other choices, but these defaults have a real impact. And, you know, what we can look for, probably less likely to see a breakup on this case, but certainly the prospect of seeing requirements similar to actually, frankly, what we saw with Microsoft years ago, where it's easier for users to choose other search engines and sort of a relaxing of that default so that it becomes a bit more of a level playing field for all the various search companies when it comes to devices, when it comes to some of these third parties.
Yeah, I guess the immediate effects, like you say, is like there's a chill effect and these huge multi-billion-dollar deals, like they're going to be cautious about that, cautious about acquisitions, not going to want to look like more of a monopolist. It's funny, some of the stuff in this, like Google was saying, well, no, the consumer's got lots of choices. We're not a monopoly. They can search using Amazon search box. What? like that's a very different thing. Like, people search all over the place. They don't just search with Google, and then they listed all of these other places. You might go into your messaging app, and so you might search on Facebook, all these walled gardens and very specific. No, that's not a Google competitor. You guys are the monopoly. And then they argue it's because we're the best, and the court wasn't buying it. And we move into the ad tech with this coming lawsuit. It really does feel like governments are actually getting tough now. And what about ours? Because there was some news about Canada and Google as well. We're going after them too for a DST tax.
Yeah, our approach has, I think, been different. And that's not to say that, you know, our competition authorities aren't sensitive to some of these issues and seized with Google and some of these other large companies. I think it's also fair to say we're a much smaller player. Our ability to exert some of these competition law or antitrust measures against these big companies isn't the same as if you're the United States or the European Union, where your markets have hundreds of millions of people. But, you know, I think that the Canadian government approach when it came to regulating big tech, rather than adopting sort of a strategy that said, we see some real potential harms here, and this is affecting businesses, affecting users, and we want to try to stop those harms from taking place. And those might well have involved both competition and also data, you know, privacy-related issues, because, of course, some of the secret sauce for these companies is to have as much data as possible. Instead, the Canadian government said, hey, why don't we just profit off of all of this?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to do this, let's make you pay, and you can fund just about anything we want, including some of our policy objectives. And so if you look at the series of laws that we've enacted or even the process of enacting, whether that's the streaming law C-11 or the news law C-18 that I know has been much discussed on your podcasts, or even C-63, the online harms bill that envisions these companies paying for the whole system to deal with online harms, or this DST, the digital services tax, it's all about trying to turn these companies almost into a policy ATM where the government gets to withdraw money, and rather than stopping them from doing stuff, let's just take money from them for doing this, and let's fund some of our pet policy projects.
And not a lot of money. If like they're shaking them down for like loose change, you know, $100 million from Google for the Online News Act, and now this 3% fee on Google Ads. I guess that could be a lot. You know, and I'm told, you know, I read about this in The Logic. A friend of Candlelin, Murad Hamadi, reported this, that this is something that Canadian news publishers have been asking for a long time, that, you know, when we sell ads, we have to charge tax on it, but Google hasn't. And it's just one more incentive that's taking the ad money away from us and over to Google. So this is going to be great for Canadian publishers. My guess is that that's not necessarily, well, let's take that money back to the Toronto Star. I don't know that it's going to have that kind of an impact, but, you know, I guess every penny helps.
Yeah, I got to say, I don't think it's quite that. We should probably distinguish between the legislation that seeks to create essentially cross-industry subsidies. So, you know, the streaming law that we want to take your money and we're going to divvy it up or have the CRTC divvy it up to a bunch of different places. Or we want the news stuff with, of course, now Google's deal to pay the $100 million a year and Meta now blocking news links. The DST is different. The DST isn't just on digital advertising. It's on a larger number of different kind of digital revenues. And it isn't small change, I have to say. Where the Parliamentary Budget Officer estimates we are talking about billions of dollars in additional revenue.
It's 3% on everything that Google charges. So that's a lot.
It's not quite everything, but it covers things like digital ads, digital marketplace, the revenues you generate from data. All those kinds of things start getting included. It is retroactive going back to 2022. So they're going retroactive back to trying to capture 3 years worth of revenue right off the top. And so the PBO, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, estimated, I think it was in the range of $7 billion, not just from Google, from all the companies that are affected by this. It's big money.
Yeah.
In some ways, that helps explain why the government has been willing to go ahead, even though there are very real risks that the U.S. is going to retaliate, arguing that this tax is discriminatory. And they have done that in other jurisdictions.
We get into trade war stuff.
Yep. And in fact, Google has started telling its advertisers that it is going to pass along most of that new tax to the advertisers themselves. So in fact, starting in October, they say that there will be a 2.5% additional fee paid for by advertisers that target Canadian users to account for the DST. Now, I should tell you, They do this in many of the jurisdictions where this DST has been levied. So they are seeking to pass along not all, but a sizable portion of these additional tax fees onto end users, which frankly raises a question, one, who's ultimately really paying here? It's going to be the advertisers themselves that pay and perhaps pass that along, of course, to consumers. And if you think about this from the media space, if you're a media buyer, your budget is not going to grow by 2.5% just because Google now added this levy. You're going to have to consider, do I advertise less digital advertising via Google, or do I shift some money from some of the other sources to Google to account for the additional costs I'm now facing for digital advertising?
Oh, yeah.
It actually, I think, could result in less spending on Canadian news services.
It could have the opposite effect. Wow. See, this shows you what a big thinker I am. I've only heard of this tax spoken of within my little bubble of publishing in Canada, where it's been lobbied for as like, this is going to be great, that we need to level the playing field on behalf of Canadian publishers. In fact, this tax represents a much larger thing, as you explained to me. The part of it that's on ads is just a fraction of that. And then a fraction of that is this idea that it's going to bring business back to legacy media players. Why would it do that when all ad spending trends have been going in the opposite direction? And I get it. Like, you can't break up these companies just in Canada. They'll just stop doing business here. You can't say you've got to sell off YouTube Canada. I understand why antitrust never happened in Canada. We kind of have to wait for America or somebody big to do it first. But by looking at this as just like, well, maybe we can get a payday here, I wonder if the Canadian approach isn't actually working the opposite, because if you essentially turn these into piggy banks or ATMs, as you say, then you need them to be dominant because you're going to build the whole Canadian media off of this new revenue that you're going to slice off of them. All this Liberal government policy objectives that are going to be funded by these taxes and these measures then are dependent on these companies maintaining their massive position. So we kind of are like, we're trying to lock them in as monopolists while the Americans are trying to break up their monopolies.
I think it's exactly right. Whether that's in the media space with the Online News Act C-18 or the Streaming Act with Bill C-11, the fact is the government increases our dependence on these large tech companies and frankly, in many respects, increases their dominance. I mean, that's the irony with so much of this stuff. We're creating laws that in some ways increase the likelihood of dominance because only some of these large players can even play in that sandbox and pay some of these kinds of fees. Many others may decide not even to enter into the Canadian market altogether. So we lose competition. We increase in many respects their dominance, and we increase our dependence on them. I mean, you know, if you take a look, let's say on the CanCon side, so that's that Bill C-11 streaming base, what's taken place since the bill passed? Suddenly big fights amongst Rogers and Bell for licensing U.S. content. It's not a focus on Canadian content. We're actually, in a sense, trying to outsource some of the payment for Canadian content to Netflix and to Amazon and to these large U.S. companies that are required to pay. And our Canadian companies are sitting there going to court and ready to fight over who gets the U.S. content and gets to license that. It's a bizarre approach that in many ways says that Canadian content decisions may ultimately get decided by Netflix or by Amazon or by Disney. And I'm not sure that really leaves us in the kind of place that the government is trying to sell, where it's, you know, in a sense, repatriating CanCon and enhancing the amount of spending that takes place. Even as, I'm sure you know, we're seeing record amounts of spending taking place already right now in Canada. So it's trying to fix a problem that may not even exist and creating a scenario whereby we are more dependent on these large tech platforms than ever before.
Michael, it's your first time on Shortcuts, but you listen every week, I assume. You know that we make it our business to duly note stories that people really shouldn't miss. Do you have something to duly note today?
I do have something to duly note. It's sort of a continuation, a little bit of our conversation around the online streaming bill. Some people will remember that as Bill C-11, and that was the bill that got a lot of attention when it came specifically to the issue of regulating user content and the notion that YouTubers and TikTokers and podcasters might find themselves subject to regulation. That legislation is now at the CRTC, the broadcast regulator, and they've started hearings focusing first not on issues about what counts as CanCon or how certain Canadian content or other content might be promoted, but rather how much some of the large companies are going to be forced to pay. It's all about a so-called base contribution. I raise this in large measure, one, because I find myself sort of nominally involved in it because I appeared before the CRTC and suddenly learned, somewhat to my surprise, that that meant that if these companies file cases in the federal court challenging it, they've got to copy me, and I'm essentially part of that same case.
You're like on an email thread you can't get off of.
Yeah, I get all these pleadings telling me that if I want to do nothing, I can do nothing, but if I want, I can actually make a filing to the court too, because this is going to essentially affect my interests, given that I appeared before the CRTC, even though they didn't listen to anything I had to say. So that, you know, there's that element, but even more from a media perspective, nobody's really duly noting it, so to speak. You know, we've got the occasional piece, Marie Wolfe at the Globe, for example, has covered it, but for the most part, we run into this, I think, really bad habit of focusing on legislation as it's being created. But so much of what really matters comes afterward in the implementation, whether through regulations or these hearings, and everybody's attention increasingly goes elsewhere. So we've got these cases, we've got these hearings, and frankly, nobody's paying all that much attention.
Well, I feel somewhat responsible. Maybe I'll do something about that. Duly noted. I want to duly note a change in plans here. Michael, as you know, on Shortcuts, we talk about the news. Today, I want to duly note some news about has been in the news quite a bit, especially here in Ontario. Social media discourse around poop in the town of Wasaga Beach, on the beach of Wasaga Beach, has sort of hit its peak poop. The reputation of a popular Ontario beach town is being gravely harmed by what its mayor says are misleading social media posts claiming the people are pooping in the sand. This is from Aaron DeAndrea at Global News. Mayor Brian Smith is calling on Premier Doug Ford to clean up the mess, which began last month after one TikTok user went viral for posting a video claiming that this has been an ongoing issue for years. So he's saying that the reputation of his town is being harmed because this isn't true. There is no poop on the beach. And yet, TikTok user Natty Lynn maintains that the mayor can say what he wants, but he can't deny all of us having experiences. If you go through my social media comments, you will see people speaking about this happening at almost every beach across Ontario, across Canada. This is not a new issue. Michael, I don't care how hard we have to dig. We are going to get to the bottom of this. I just want to put that on your radar and the radar of everybody else who feels like they have a right to know.
Well, duly noted.
That's Shortcuts, Michael. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a great discussion.
I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send in. Michael Geist, where can people find you and where can they listen to your excellent podcast?
Well, thanks, Jesse. They can find me online at michaelgeist.ca or Twitter at mgeist, M-G-E-I-S-T. The podcast that I put out on digital policy in Canada is called Law Bites, and they can find it on their favorite podcast app, much like they find Canada Land's great podcast.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson, with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Quicksand coming up over my head. Never heard nothing the old woman said. Her dishcloth's cleaning out all of my brain. All I know is that I'll never be the same. Oh. Over the hill, trying to find something he never will. His daddy said that boy won't amount to much. too busy drinking and dreaming answers. Said nothing good will come from this. Don't accept nothing, not even a kiss. Baby girl born for blushing. No one knew of her, not even her. Sand coming up over my head. Never heard nothing the old woman said. Her disc claws cleaning out all of my brain. All I know is that I'll never be the same.
good.
No Static. Every Monday from 6